Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for May 2018, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This month's interview is with author R.J. Smith about his book, American Witness, The Art and Life of Robert Frank. R.J. Smith wrote an acclaimed biography of James Brown a few years ago called The One, and now R.J. has written the first in-depth biography of the renowned photographer and filmmaker Robert Frank, best known for his landmark book, The Americans. American Witness is a comprehensive look at the life of a man who's as mysterious and evasive as he is prolific and gifted, leaving his rigid Switzerland for the more fluid United States in 1947, Robert Frank found himself at the red-hot social center of Bohemian New York in the 50s and 60s, becoming fast friends with everyone from Jack Kerouac to photographer Walker Evans. Frank roamed the country with his young family, taking almost 30,000 photographs and collecting 83 of them into what is still his most famous work, The Americans. His was an America nobody had seen before, and if it was harshly criticized upon publication for its portrait of a divided country, the collection gradually grew to be recognized as a transformative American vision. And after that, Robert Frank turned his back on certain success, giving up photography to reinvent himself as a film and video maker, working with everyone from the Rolling Stones to Tom Waits to New Order. American Witness is a portrait of a singular artist and the country that he saw. I began my interview with R.J. Smith by asking him what it was like to write a book about Robert Frank without a ton of direct cooperation from the great artist.
You know, I'd just written a book before that about James Brown, and I wanted to write about somebody who was with us and who could be involved in some way in the process. And in his own Robert Frankian way, he kind of was involved. His involvement, as it does in many things in his life, I gather, you know, amounted to kind of a shrug and a look away, but neither a yes or a no. Just kind of, he would tell people that this guy has been calling me, wants to interview me. Is that okay? And Robert apparently was telling people, yeah, that's fine. So he totally knew about it from the beginning. You know, I always knew that I wanted his voice, his thoughts, as much as I could get him to talk. I wanted that. But, you know, I mean, writing about Robert Frank is like writing about Bob Dylan, it very much in a lot of ways. And, you know, you're never going to get Bob Dylan to sit down and do a lot of interviews for your book about him. He just doesn't. He doesn't do that, and Robert does that even less. So it wasn't in any way a surprise that I couldn't get his help. He's never, you know. Well, now once in recent years, for an authorized project, he sat down and talked to a writer. But otherwise, he's just never gone over the course of his life very much with anybody with a tape recorder. I don't know that he even likes to think about his own life story, particularly.
Among the people who you did interview, who was the most forthcoming, who had the most interesting things to say and the most interesting stories about Robert Frank's life and career?
Well, you know, one interesting thing, I mean, a benefit of living, well, he's 93 now, and, you know, he has outlived, you know, his friends who were abstract expressionist artists and beats and, you know, people from the 1960s New York City independent cinema movement. He's lived longer than people he photographed at CBGB in the 1970s. So there's lots and lots of people from Zurich on who knew him in one segment or other of his life. One person that was incredibly helpful and I would, you know, he certainly needs to be written about on his own is the photographer Danny Lyon, who first, well, was incredibly inspired by Robert Frank and by the Americans, became a good friend of Robert Frank's in the 60s and early 70s, worked with him on some projects, and ultimately, you know, was kind of sent packing by Robert Frank, as kind of happens with many friends in his life. So Danny had an amazing set of stories and remembrances and a really clear idea as one artist talking about another. He had a great understanding of some of the things Robert has done in his life that maybe puzzle me or puzzle other people. He really sees him in a deep way.
Mm-hmm. This is completely jumping out of the chronology, but your book is... Oh, so fascinating, and at times so disturbing. I mean, the Robert Frank has an artistic temperament that makes, someone like Joni Mitchell look calm and peaceful through her career. And, of course, she isn't and hasn't been. And there's just one passage that's so riveting and so disturbing when you talk about Robert Frank having deliberately having someone drill holes through some of his own photographs in this act of... willful destruction that it's, I've been around a lot of artists and musicians, and it was just painful to read this, why someone would do this and how they could be in such a self-destructive mental state to destroy their greatest work. Tell that story, and what possibly could have been Robert Frank's motivation to do this?
Yeah. Well, of course, why so many people's lives were changed by Robert Frank's art was probably at first, at least, because of that book, The Americans. And after he had finished work on it, you know, even before it was published in America, Robert started thinking about moving away from photography and becoming a filmmaker. And he was always, he never wanted and never wants to repeat himself, and he always wants to take the hard road and to take a turn that people don't expect. He'd rather be impoverished, although ironically he's certainly not impoverished today, but for much of his life, you know, he did everything he could to not be famous and to not be celebrated. And he came to look, I think, years later at that body of work that we call The Americans as, to some degree, a stone around his neck that he had to symbolically destroy to go on and to keep being creative. That was the way I think he partly looked at it. There's also, and he literally did that a number of times with drill bits. He filmed it, and it became a part of a film that he made. It also became part of a sculpture, a big wrapped parcel of those destroyed images from The Americans. You know, one little side note, he had an amazing, fascinating art dealer named Harry Lunn, who was one of the people who really created the modern market for photography. He got photographers' work to be priced and celebrated the way painters' work had been celebrated. And Harry Lunn is a graduate of the University of Michigan, was editor of the Michigan Daily, or at least op-ed editor of the Michigan Daily, went on to be a CIA operative, and finally, in the last decades of his life, became this amazing, successful art dealer. But Robert became much better off because of Harry Lunn, but also came to really resent the business practices of the marketplace, and Harry Lunn maybe in particular. And I think destroying his work was in a way a symbolic act of severing his relationship with Harry Lunn.
Fascinating. Well, let's talk about this book. Love it or hate it, Robert Frank is always going to be known first and foremost for this incredible book of photographs, The Americans, and a number of images shot right here in Ann Arbor and in Detroit. How did this project come about? Now, he had lived for how long? He was born in Switzerland. And then what got him interested in photography, and how did The Americans happen?
Yeah, well, he was growing up, obviously he just had an amazing visual sense all his own. He was growing up in Europe and in Zurich, which was a huge publishing empire. It was as good a place, perhaps, as any place on earth to be a photojournalist in the 30s and 40s, because the handheld, portable cameras were in ascendance. A whole new style of photojournalism was being celebrated and was getting paid for. Journalists were getting paid better than they had before. So he was soaking it all up. And he comes to America in 1947, after World War II, when he can leave. And he becomes, for a few years, a fashion photographer. Incredibly successful. He was a peer of Richard Avedon's. He could have easily had that kind of a career. But he goes his own way. He starts traveling around the world. He quits his fashion photography job. And then back in New York in the early 50s, he's wondering what to do. With his friend, the amazing photographer Walker Evans, they kind of discuss getting a Guggenheim grant. Evans had a couple of Guggenheim fellowships just before, and they decided, you know, they kind of cooked up this idea together of looking at the country, hitting a road, getting in a car, not together. This would be Robert's project, and seeing. You know, it was a time, the mid-50s, the Cold War, the Beats are in ascendance, on the road. You know, there's a whole new kind of comedy, a whole new kind of independent cinema being born. There's the New York School of Poetry. There's just so much culturally going on where people are looking at America beyond what the mass media is showing, beyond what the government is saying about America. People are asking questions and digging deeper. And it was a great time to be on the road and look at the stories and the people that you don't see in your daily paper or on the nightly news. And that's what Frank did. And that's what the Americans, in part, became, was, you know, like an ultimate kind of a set of images of what was going on in the country, civil rights things, and people who were below the poverty level, the kind of hate and loneliness and isolation and hope and beauty that are all out there beyond what we see in the mass media. He wasn't editorializing. He wasn't doing kind of documentary journalism that, you know, the WPA photographers did, you know, with a mission to change the way the world is. I think Robert shared some of their goals for sure, but his was a much more personal and elliptical and poetic vision that people are still unpacking today and trying to understand the messages that are there.
What brought him specifically to Detroit and also to Ann Arbor? Did he talk or write about why he took photos here?
That's a great question. I know he came, for starters, to photograph the River Rouge plant. And I know, like so many people then and, you know, onward, looked at Detroit as being, you know, the greatest possible manifestation of American industrialization. So he wanted to see that up close, and he luckily was able to get, you know, kind of a rare tour. This is a rare tour of the plant, and he came up with some kind of intense, dusty-looking, dark images of workers. And I think, along with this, and this is true for so much of the Americans, he kind of set his map on a city for an idea or two, a goal or two, like the plant. And then he got there and he just kind of drove around, and people would tell him about things, or something would just catch his fancy, whether it's Briggs Stadium or a parking lot. And he would just stay, well, he'd stay overnight or for a couple of weeks sometimes, depending on what he wanted to do. And I just think the abundance of, you know, the mix of images he takes from the area, public parks, kids, you know, kids doing what kids do in public settings, and workers and cars, always lots of cars with Robert Frank.
And jukeboxes.
Jukeboxes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He just, well, you know, at the end of the day, you have to consider that maybe Detroit became you know, kind of emblematic for the whole of the whole country for him.
Hmm. And how many images did he shoot, and how many were edited down, like the final version of The Americans? Talk about an editing process. And how did he do that editing? What photos made the final cut? How do you see the themes of The Americans, RJ?
Yeah, well, he shot hundreds and hundreds of rolls of film, and, you know, came up with thousands of candidate images, because he was on the road on and off for 2.5 years, something like that. And, you know, he was editing sometimes on the road. He stopped in Los Angeles and the Bay Area and worked in friends' dark rooms there. And then he came back to New York in 56, 57 and works just in a fever there, and he gets it down to the handful of images that are in The Americans, and the process is intuitive and instinctive, and, you know, he makes it kind of clear that, that there's no definitive version of The Americans in a funny way. There's the one that we all, well, there have been a number of additions that have come out over the years, and he's made changes. He's added an image, he's changed the cropping a little bit, he changes the printing process and the whole look of the work sometimes. So I don't know. There's no definitive version of The Americans in a funny way, although there's the one that you buy that we all know.
Yeah. Now, was the book immediately thought highly of by critics? Did it sell well when it first came out, in the late 1950s, 58, around then?
That's right. It was 58 in France and 59 in the United States. No. And that's a big part of the story, too, is that, there's the famous, what's the famous line about the first Velvet Underground album, which is that, almost nobody heard it, but everybody that did hear it formed their own rock and roll band.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, The Americans was attacked, although not universally, but by many people. It was attacked in print by photographic critics when it came out. It didn't sell very well at all, quickly remaindered, but it instantly mattered to people like Danny Lyon, Dion Arbus, you know, generations of photographers whose whole way of looking at the world was at least in part shaped by what Frank was doing. And over time, yeah, it's just kind of grown to be a touchstone. Until today, it's one of those classic kind of works that you have to define yourself against, almost, to have a. In fact, there are any number of artists who have said some have said that they've been inspired, of course, by The Americans, and some have said they've had to change their whole way of working or their whole media. Mm-hmm. Ed Ruscha's thought of being a photographer, and then The Americans just made him think about becoming more of a painter and printmaker. Mm. You know, there's a lot of people like that. It's just a thing that's kind of hard to ever get beyond.
And so right around the time that the book was coming out, Robert Frank was already starting to shift at least somewhat towards making films instead of taking photographs.
Yeah. He was working on a film called Pull My Daisy, which I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan, and I think I saw Pull My Daisy in Lorch Hall back in the day, the old architecture A&D building.
What year did you graduate?
Oh, 81.
All right. A couple years after me. I graduated in 76. How cool.
Oh, right on. Well, there you go. Yeah, so I saw Pull My Daisy there, and I totally remember it. But the thing, yeah, and he went on to have this fascinating, little understood or looked at kind of career as an inspiring video and filmmaker. So he knew even before The Americans came out in America, he knew what he had. I mean, he's such a, he just has the skills and a brilliant way of looking and living that he knew he had made something great. And he knew that that was enough for him, and he wanted to not repeat himself. Even before anybody in America hardly had seen it, he was already pushing off and going into something new, filmmaking. And Pull My Daisy, although visually there's certainly an overlap, one could say perhaps, with the Americans, it's a whole new thing. It's a whole new thing in film and in terms of what Robert Frank was doing. And he just took it on from there.
And in both The Americans and Pull My Daisy, the great author Jack Kerouac has an important role. Talk about that and how they first met.
Yeah. Well, they met at a party that Lucien Carr, one of the beat anchors, was having a party. And I think Robert had already known Allen Ginsberg by then. And he was at the party. And this is right after On the Road had come out. And the review had just been in the New York Times, very, very favorable. And Kerouac came by. Well, Robert was looking for somebody to write the introduction for a book that hadn't come out yet, The Americans, and he had already had an introduction assigned to his good friend Walker Evans, but he thought a younger or more experimental voice would be more appropriate to what he was doing. He'd actually approached William Faulkner, who we did not know, about writing the introduction, and never got anywhere with that. But when he met Kerouac and they started talking, it was pretty clear that they had a lot in common, and they had a vision in a general sense of American life and what made it exciting and overwhelming and what could kill you about American life. And they hit it off, and so Frank asked them to write something, and very quickly Kerouac turned an amazing piece of writing around and presented it to Robert. And then another amazing thing happened, which was that Robert asked Kerouac to rewrite it, which one just did not do to Jack Kerouac, but Kerouac added some to it to make it longer, which was necessary, and it's an amazing piece of writing. It helped helped explain somehow, or frame, I guess, what Frank was doing to an audience that might not have been able to quite get it so quickly.
Besides Pull My Daisy, the other work that is, I would say, easily the best known of Robert Frank's films is the one with the notorious title. We'll just call it Blankety Blank Blues. And this is the notorious documentary he made about the Rolling Stones on tour. And Robert, of course, also is responsible for the cover artwork for the Stones album Exile on Main Street. Talk about that album and the art and this incredible film and why nobody can see it for the most part.
Well, you know, one story is that I think I heard that Charlie Watts was a fan of The Americans and wanted Robert involved. Other people said other people around the Stones were actually the conduits. But clearly the Stones camp knew about Robert, liked his work, and wanted access to his vision. It started with that photographic collage that appears on the cover of Exile on Main Street, and while they were working on that, they asked Robert to travel with them on their 1972 tour of the United States, and just make something. You know, you have to say the Stones have been involved with so many fascinating, not normal kinds of film projects that you have to give them all an amazing amount of credit for not just wanting somebody to do what they wanted to do, but letting artists do what artists want to do.
Well, that only goes
so far with when I ended up working with Robert, but I still give them a lot of credit for what they did. So they let Robert and a friend named Danny Seymour follow them virtually everywhere with handheld cameras. And record all kinds of stuff, and the work that they came up with, So and So Blues, is a work that is not full of music, although it's about a rock and roll band. I think Robert has said he didn't really like the Rolling Stones music that much, but he was fascinated by the aura of the Stones and the power of who they were as people and as a cultural force. And that's what the film is about. It's about being incredibly rich and famous and always in motion, and how alienating and powerful and horrible that can be. And it's a dark amazing kind of, a visual poem about isolation and very much about America, and not very much about music, ultimately. So while when it was done, Robert spent a couple years on and off editing, assembling it, getting into the shape that he was happy with. In that period of time, Keith Richards had been arrested for a heroin possession charge in Toronto, and the Stones realized that there are a lot of scenes of drug use and many other debauched subjects in this film, and that if that film, which was getting ready for a commercial release, came out, that the Rolling Stones would never be able to play in the United States again, because Richards was supposed to go on trial, and here was visual evidence of, you know, it would be entered as a court document, perhaps. So they suppressed it, ultimately. Anybody who tried to tell Robert how to crop a photograph or how to order a series of images or how to edit a film or anything, they're not gonna get a warm reception. And so when it got to that stage, well, we'd love the work, we just want you to cut out these scenes, and we'll be happy. Well, Robert probably added more of those scenes at that point.
Uh-huh.
And so at the end of the day, they sued him. They had final ownership, and they have sat on it ever since with a proviso that a couple times a year it can be screened as long as Robert is there to introduce the film to an audience. And Frank is the kind of guy that he doesn't want to talk about himself. He doesn't want to talk about his work. And you know, he would rather have an operation without anesthesia than to have to talk about why he made the choices he made in his art. So it almost never gets shown. And it's a shame, because it is an incredible piece of work. And if you get a good print of it, it's available in bootleg contexts. Chunks of it go up on YouTube all the time and get pulled down very quickly. It's not worth seeing the bad versions, but if you get a right, complete version, it's an amazing piece of work. It's one of the best things he's ever done.
Mm. Couple more questions, RJ, and we'll let you go. Let's discuss Robert's personal life, which is just been filled with many, many tragic events, and certainly that has colored, I would say, his art, which is, while never particularly optimistic, is taken a pretty melancholy tone in the wake of the passing of both of his children. Talk about that. Talk about his personal life.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that this book really became is a book about what being an artist in America can mean, and what it can cost one who does it however well or not well at all, in terms of your personal life, in terms of your connections with the rest of the world, in terms of your relationship with money. There's something really overwhelming and powerful and horrible about sometimes what American culture does to American artists. And Robert was devoted to his work more than anything else in his life, and he still is. And his friendships have completely suffered, and he's the classic kind of person who he just cuts you off one day almost and just turns away and finds new friends. And you might never know why he did that, but you know, or he'd leave you wondering. And lovers have been like that with him, and his children both died. His children both died, and he always. I think in the work that he's made, he makes it clear that he feels that he knows how much time he spent with his work and with making art, and he knows he wasn't the kind of parent that he wished he'd been, and it's clearly haunted him, and it's clearly shaped the work that he's made since. But both his children died in terrible and very sad ways. He hardly ever talks about it, and it's shaped him. It's really shaped him.
You mentioned Robert is now 93. How is he? How is his health? And is he still working? Is he still taking photographs? Is he making films? What is he doing these days? And where is he living?
Well, you know, he's in the phone book. He is literally, although he's hard to get on the phone, you can call his number, and he's an odd mix of public and private. He lives in Greenwich Village much of the year, in, you know, Bleecker and Bowery, and you can in these days, what he does a lot of the time when he's home is sit up on the second or third floor and look out the window and look at people walking down the street. I saw him answer some questions in a Q&A thing, a rare public appearance, about 3 years ago now. And he was all there. He was all there. I talked to him afterwards. For somebody who's 93, I think he's fairly present. Now, as to is he making work now, you know, for a number of years, here's what somebody close to him has told me, which is for a number of years, for maybe decades now, actually, Robert's public line is he doesn't do that anymore. He doesn't take pictures. He's hung up his camera. But I'm told when you get together with him, when you hang out with him, probably even this week, maybe, I don't know, but at least in recent times, he's got a camera in his hand. He's taking pictures of something, whether that's just, you know, a lifelong reflex, or maybe we'll see those images someday. I don't know, but I think he's still, until recently at least, yeah, still at work.
Mm. All right, one final question, RJ. What's your favorite image of Robert Franks? Not necessarily from the Americans, but is there one that just captivates you, haunts you, thrills you the most of any of Robert's photographs?
I'll tell you that there's a series that he did right after the Americans. He would take buses in New York City and take a seat, pull out his camera, and shoot through the window. And he let the driver of the bus and the bus route and the traffic of New York City kind of determine what was in front of him and what wasn't. And it's kind of the other end of the telescope from the way he worked from the Americans, where he stopped wherever he wanted and shot and did it his way. Here, you know, accident and the city and life are putting the rules for him to work by. And it's just called kind of the New York City bus, a group of images. And they've been exhibited a number of times. They are amazing and kind of more mysterious and more casual and just full of a kind of life that, it captures a vision of New York City and any city that I think is still has a lot to say.
Thanks for listening to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for May 2018. Our interview was with author R.J. Smith about the book American Witness, The Art and Life of Robert Frank. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.
Answer me. Why won't you answer me? I can't recall the day that I last heard from you.